G'day everybody. Welcome back to another episode of The Birder's Guide. How are we all? Have we managed to get out and about this week now that restrictions have decided to ease up a little bit? I said last week that I was hoping to get to Brookfield or Tolderol, but meetings and the availability of cars has got in the way of that. But this morning, I spent the morning at the Mount Lofty Botanic Gardens, which are a brilliant place in their own right. They're probably not the most species-rich location in the area, but a really nice place to spend the morning regardless. And it was cool, and it was raining, and that is my two favourite types of weather, so I really couldn't complain. I did manage to find 23 species, including a pair of golden whistlers, a pair of scarlet robins, an eastern spinebill, three little wattle birds, and all the other usual Adelaide Hills suspects. Unfortunately, no Bayesian thrush, which currently holds the position of being my bogey bird. Not that South Australia is a particularly great place to look for them, but they seem to have eluded me more than most. So now that people are getting out and about, we've got some reports coming in from around the country of things worth going out and looking for. So I'll just go through some of the ones that I've found. There's not much happening around South Australia currently. In Victoria, on the 17th of May, there was a, or 16th and 17th, in Victoria, there was a male glossy black cockatoo at the Moree Jarvis, I think that's how you pronounce it, woodlands. But that might still be around somewhere, so keep an eye out if you see any black cockatoos with red tails. On the 19th of May, at the Eastern Treatment Plant, not to be confused with the better known Western Treatment Plant, there was a pair of chestnut breasted mannequins, or mooneyers, depending on which name you want to use. So that was, 3 days ago, so they might still be around there as well. That'd be quite good. And in Broome, some feral pigeons turned up, which they do from time to time, but hopefully they don't make too much of a habit of it. So we'll keep an eye on things as we go into the future, and hopefully more and more things will turn up once people get out and about a bit. But in the meantime, let's get into today's conversation.
You're listening to The Birder's Guide with Michael Greenschutz.
So on the show today, we are lucky enough to have Matt Crawford with us. I got onto Matt when he posted some numbers he'd crunched onto the Victorian Birders Facebook page, and he agreed to come and share some of his thoughts. So Matthew, welcome to the Birders Guide. It's great to have you on the show.
Hey, thanks very much, Michael.
When I first thought about asking you to come on the show, I didn't actually know this about you, but you are a radio presenter for the ABC. How does one get into that?
Well, you've got ambitions to take your podcast to greater heights, dear Michael. I've been working in broadcasting my whole career. So I've been, I've passed two decades and well on the way to three in broadcasting, and it's treated me really well. It's been hard work. I relocated from New Zealand to Australia about 10 years ago and had to sort of restart everything then because I wanted to work in the same field, but in a new audience with a new realm, I guess, of possibility. And so it was sort of, tough to restart, but well worth it in the end. So I'm working at the ABC. I work as an audio engineer, actually, but I do a bunch of different work, and I've done a bit of science and environment reporting over the years. So, I've had a really interesting run. I mean, I had the amazing privilege to do a media trip down to Macquarie Island in the sub-Antarctic in 2012, and I'd love to go and do a follow-up on that because that was when they were doing the pest eradication project down there. But in 2012, it was only in that year that I really sort of really got back into birding and discovering all, the amazing birds and birding opportunities that Australia offers. I've never looked back. No offense to New Zealand, which I also love, but I'm having such a great time in Australia. I've not really thought of going back yet.
So you said you got back into birding. Were you a birder previously in New Zealand or just sort of recently?
I I enjoyed the bird life of New Zealand, and I think it was that cataloguing instinct that birders have that was first tripped off for me when I was in New Zealand. I moved to a place in my teens that had a beautiful view of this like bush-clad valley on the outskirts of Auckland, and there was this kind of conservatory style window that looked across the valley, and I remember there was a tree right there on which birds would sing from. It was a great sort of little territorial spot for a bird to make its presence known. But one of the previous tenants in the place had left behind a bird guide book, which I still have. And it kind of just set off that instinct, which I guess a lot of birders have, that you just want to know one more. You want to like figure out just one more of the callers in the neighborhood, and be able to identify them is a challenge. And that was the start of it back then, but I didn't really have the opportunity to take it too far at that time. And like I said, it wasn't really until I got to Australia and I was a couple of years in that I really, I guess, really got back into it and realized that, the possibilities are almost endless.
You're obviously quite keen on data and statistics, a man after my own heart, but we will we'll get to that in a minute. Does your work with the ABC allow you to do any avian related research or shows or anything like that?
Well, in the science and environment reporting that I've done, I have had that opportunity to follow bird stories or stories that might affect birds. I did a series with Tim Entwistle, the director of the Royal Botanic Gardens in Victoria, called In Season a few years ago, which was based on his book, Sprinter and Sprummer, Australia's Changing Seasons. And so that was a terrific project to be involved in. The subtext of that, I suppose, was that it was really a show about climate change in the end and the effect that it has on so many aspects of the natural world. But aside from larger scale projects like that, I do a couple of fun things. I do an occasional birding talk back with Libby Gore on ABC Victoria, and that's on a Saturday morning. And that's just, it's very fun. It's very light. It's Libby encourages people to call in with their bird songs that they're trying to identify in their neighborhood. And I have a very valiant attempt at trying to identify, from people whistling on the radio down the phone line and stuff. Trying to a very valiant attempt at trying to guess what all the calls might be. I don't know that my success rate is terribly high, but look, I think I could throw in enough fun facts in a chat like that to a reasonably broad audience across Victoria to hopefully awaken a little bit of knowledge and hunger for knowledge in people about what is in the world around them. And just once in a while, you'll just get a caller who'll say, "Oh, wood swallows. You've told me about the wood swallows. I've never known what they are. And like, thank you. You've just like the penny's finally dropped and you've finally told me about what that species is, what those species are, in fact. And I'm just so grateful that you were able to do that." And I mean, it's stuff like that that really makes your day doing a project like that. I do another one as well. It's called Tweet of the Week. It's a mystery bird call segment on Sunday Extra on Radio National. So if you ever listen to Radio National at 9:05 on a Sunday morning, you'll hear Julian Morrow, who's the presenter of Sunday Extra these days. He'll read out a challenge, an audio challenge. Sometimes it's a little puzzle involved as well. And basically it's about identifying a bird or birds and people text in with their answers. So that one's quite fun as well. I've been preparing that one, writing that one up for about 6 years now. So that's been a really fun one to do.
Yeah, nice. Moving away from the ABC and moving into birding, one rite of passage, so to speak, for any serious birder is the National Twitchathon, which, if I recall correctly, you've been involved in Victoria for a few years. Are you one of the hardcore 24-hour, or I think it's 30-hour now, or are you a more subdued 12-hour sort of guy?
Well, interesting, because this is exactly how radio and birding came together for me. So it was in again in 2012 that I met Michael Ramsey, and Michael has since become a great friend of mine. And at that time, he was racing in the 24-hour, as it was then, Twitchathon in Victoria, and I was making a radio documentary about it. So It's a while ago now. People can still find it if they just search for Twitchathon Off Track Radio National or something. You'll be able to find it. So, look, I stayed in touch with Michael and we've become friends. And since he's moved down to Melbourne from country Victoria, we actually have joined up as a team to compete in the Twitchathon. And for the last few years, I don't think that he or even perhaps I have been quite up for doing the big challenge. It is the 24-hour race, which is now officially 30 hours because there's a mandatory six-hour rest break overnight to try and stop all those people from going too crazy by racing overnight and driving all through the night when they probably should be, for safety's sake, taking a proper rest. So we've been doing the 12. It was an eight-hour race, I think, in 2015, and it's been a 12-hour race ever since. And look, it's been an absolute blast. We so look forward to it every year. We've been doing basically the same route ever since it's been a 12-hour race. We've been doing the same route. And we've been honing it every year. Michael spots the birds first. He's an extremely good birder. He's just phenomenal with picking up calls at extraordinary range. So I hold the clipboard and I'm in charge of the timekeeping and the route planning and stuff. Well, we do the route planning collaboratively, but we've been honing it every year. And in any 5-minute period in that 12-hour Twitchathon, we know exactly where we're going to be, whether it's in transit or whether it's at a site, how long we're going to spend at that site, how many kilometers we need to get to the next site. And that's really been the secret to, well, I guess our success with... we've actually won that 12-hour race every time we've entered it in Victoria.
That's impressive.
And yeah, well, we're doing fine, and it's like I say, it is for fun. And I, you know, the larger purpose, of course, is that we're raising funds for BirdLife Australia's science and conservation efforts. So that's what it's really all about. But you know, from a fun aspect, and you know, I think birders are often a little bit competitive. It has been, you know, it has been a lot of fun. And what we've decided to do provisionally for 2020 is to, we started to wonder if the fact that we have always won the 12-hour event, if that might be a bit of a disincentive to other teams to get involved. So we've actually decided to change it up this year. I said, look, well, why don't we just go either to the Birdathon, which is a 3x1-hour event, or go to the big one, the 30-hour event. And at the moment, we're running with the idea of doing the 30-hour event in 2020 in Victoria. It does, of course, depend on whether BirdLife runs the event this year or whether there's any other changes with all the, you know, the pandemic circumstances that are going down. So we'll wait and see how all that pans out. But yes, so we're thinking of just changing up our plans again, making it a bit different, and giving someone else a clear run in the 12-hour if they fancy having a go at that title. And maybe, who knows, going for a new record in the 30-hour in Victoria, that's yet to be seen. But look, it's a lot of fun. It's a big motivator right throughout the year. We do talk about it as the year goes by and ideas to refine the route. But yeah, we'll see how we go, Michael. It's something I'm looking forward to, you know, see how it goes. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, no, that sounds great. Just for those who are listening who might not know what a Twitchathon is, I've just thought of this. Do you want to give us a quick 30-second rundown on what a Twitchathon actually is?
Okay. The goal of the Twitchathon is to work in teams along a route of your own choosing to see and hear as many birds as possible. And the key to it really is to get through lots of different habitat types to get your species count up. And there are those three events. There's a 30-hour event, the 12-hour event, and there's that beginner-friendly Birdathon event, which you can do in 3 1-hour clumps, where you can sort of combine them into, you know, like a 3-hour big sit somewhere or whatever you like, really. So it's a little bit more of a lower entry bar for people who want to get into it. That's the Birdathon aspect of the National Twitchathon.
Yeah, nice. So just before we get into the data that I actually asked you to come on the show to talk about, just two questions. What's the most number of species you've seen in the Twitchathon, and what's been your best find?
Right. Oh, the best find. Well, it changes every year, the best find. Oh, no, I do have an answer for that. I've just thought of it. So our best year, I think, was 2 years ago. Yeah, 2018 was the year that we scored 188 in the 12-hour Twitchathon in Victoria.
That is impressive.
Well, it was a big, they're always a big day, but that was obviously a really big day. And we were already raked in the species, which was a real delight. I don't know what went so well about that day. I guess the weather conditions in Victoria had been good. When I look back, do you know what? I think it might have actually been 2017, because I think 2018 might have been a bit light on, and then 2019 we brought it back a bit again. So yes, it was 2017 that we got that record of 188, and they do a national sort of algorithm formula thing, and they sort of worked it all out, and we'd come out on top when we sort of compared Victoria's possibilities against the rest of the states. I think mainly because actually we scored more than the theoretical maximum that the formula even allowed. So so we really cleaned up in that particular year. I think that was the year in 2017 that we scored. We were in some of our drier woodland habitat, and you know, I think you've always got to be happy when a square-tailed kite shows up, but one just floated over us at that moment. You know, they're just so random when they just show up, aren't they? If you don't know if there's a nest around, and suddenly there it was, square-tailed kite just floating over us. I think I probably had a little bit of a tear in the eye because it's just such a magical thing when it happens. And yeah, that was definitely one of our best birds for that year.
So the reason I've asked you to actually come on the show is that you've recently had a look at some data about birds. And for those of you who are on the Victorian Birders Facebook page, Matthew recently put up a post about this. For those of you who aren't, I'll put a link to his report in the podcast information. So Matthew, can you give us a rundown on what you looked at?
Yeah, so I'm a real enthusiast for eBird. I do a bird list wherever I go. I try to make it a good bird list, which means that I will make it limited to just one site, and I'll try and not to make it too much of a long duration checklist. So I like an eBird checklist where I'm submitting a record of what I see and hear to eBird. I like to make it good data, and I'm enthusiastic about getting up my year counts. It's a way to keep track of my life list and my year list and my Victoria list and my Australia list and my world list, of course. And submitting these checklists and good data checklists as I go throughout the year and throughout my life, I guess, means that not only am I counting for myself, I'm counting for citizen science, and helping our understanding of changing birding patterns. What I've been interested to do is to examine some of the data, because it's all publicly accessible in eBird. Like, anyone can download the histogram data or even have access to the complete data set in eBird if you just fill in a little request for it. And what I was interested to do was, really, I mean, it all starts off selfishly, this kind of thing. It's like, have I seen less of this bird? Have I seen less of that bird? Does the data support that? I think we've always got to be cautious about anecdotal evidence of changing patterns in the birds that we see and hear. And so what I wanted to do was to actually look at the data as well and to see to what extent what I've noticed, or perhaps what other people talk about, is supported by the data that's been submitted to eBird. So I've been doing this for a couple of years, and I think this is each year I've just tried to make the data a little bit better, or the way I write it up a little bit better, a little bit more comprehensive. One of the criticisms I had maybe in past years was that I had it separated out the data between Melbourne and Victoria. And so people wondered if the changing patterns were due to the fact that maybe newer birders were coming online and that perhaps they were more based in areas in or adjacent to Melbourne. Now, I'm not sure that that assumption is actually supported by the data that's in there, but I still think it's a good idea to separate it out anyway, because it means I can write it up separately and it's more meaningful to people based on where they are. So I've started in 2020. I've written up I've written up an article on I published through Medium, so you can find it on Medium if you just do a search for and thank you for posting the link, Michael, but if you just do a search for Melbourne's much-loved birds show signs of decline, that's the article I've done this year, and it's I guess it's got some interesting findings.
So one of the questions that I came up with when I was just reading through it was, and you did mention this before, but is there any chance that perhaps more eBird lists are just being recorded in areas that these birds don't live? So, for example, if we take superb fairy wren, you say in 2015 they showed up in 28% of lists. Now, 28%, like a third, that's a huge, that is a huge amount for one species to turn up. And then you say in 2019 it was 18.5. So you personally don't think that perhaps people are just doing reports more where there are no superb fairy wrens?
I can't tell is the honest answer to that, Michael. What I can't tell is yet, and I wouldn't mind looking at it over time, is the changing habits of e-birding, right? So are people making more lists but shorter, which is actually good for data, and therefore are they excluding birds that would otherwise have shown up had they been doing a longer list that covered more space? Yeah. I don't know is the answer. I can't tell from the data that we've got. So I'm happy to get that up front. This data is very interesting, but it doesn't answer all questions. So I'm happy to leave some things unanswered and we'll cover that as we go, I suppose. Yeah. But yeah, so just, I guess, summarizing just what you said there, I can look across the 5 years. Superb fairy wren, this is the reporting rate of the species in checklists that were submitted from local government authority areas in or around Melbourne. Mm. So this covers something like 49,000 checklists that e-birders, when they submitted them, marked as complete. So it's a pretty big whack of data. And as you said, 28% of all of those checklists submitted from Greater Melbourne in 2015, 28% of them included the superb fairy wren or had the superb fairy wren on them. That fell in each of the 5 years that I've reported on here. So it went from 28 to about 25.5 to about 22.5 to 19 to 18.5. I've probably got one more decimal point here than what I published on the article that you saw. But that to me isn't a blip. It's a consistent downturn, and that's why I thought it really worth mentioning.
Mm, yeah. Well, I mean, it means something, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I'm also at pains to point out that, you know, this is not a systematic survey and it doesn't necessarily tell us what the population size of the superb fairy wren is in those Melbourne suburbs or what the trend in that, and therefore what the trend in that population might be. But it does tell us straight up a simple question. How many times on a checklist that's submitted to eBird, does a species show up? And in this case, it's falling. And you might argue, well, if a species that's assumed to be so common, like the superb fairy wren, is apparently declining in that reporting rate, in the number of times it shows up, or in the frequency that it shows up on eBird checklists, that still tells us something. Mm. And what it also allows us to do is we can compare up and down the list, right? So I can say that the superb fairy wren was near the bottom of the way that I've sorted this, right? I mean, I've got the source data here, so I can do a little bit more with it. But the superb fairy wren fell by what I would regard as quite a worrying amount in that time. Yeah. And whereas I can look further up the list, and I've narrowed it down to what I've got here. I've got 287 species. I've got a fair number of bird species listed here. I look at the top. And you compare what I just told you. I told you about those declining percentages on the superb fairy wren. I look right at the top of the list and I've got Pied Currawong. Okay, 5 years again. I'll go from 2015 to 2019. 15.5%, 16, nearly 17, 18 and a bit, and then a little decline at the end down to 17. So that's, apart from one blip at the end, I suppose, that is a consistent rise up.
Yeah.
So what does that tell us? I can almost sort of group this list into sort of three segments. A small number of species that have an increasing reporting rate, quite a large number that have either a steady or a slightly falling reporting rate, and a small number that have gone down really quite a lot. And so whatever other limitations that you might say the data has, what it does allow you to do is just compare the changing reporting rates across the number of species that we've seen in the Greater Melbourne area across these 5 years and see which ones are doing better or worse than others.
And is there anything, like if you take those three groups, is there anything that stands out for each one? Like, is, say, introduced species getting more common and small species getting less common, or is there anything you can take from that, or is it sort of spread out pretty well?
It's, look, it's a mixed bag. Like, when you say a small species getting less common, well, what I can say, and instead of saying common, I suppose I should say, you know, is the reporting rate getting more or less frequent? Because that's strictly speaking what I am talking about here. Some of the usual suspects you can see apparently doing quite well. Pied Currawong, we know that that's increasing in the cities, and in fact, you know, I know it's increasing in Victoria as well, the reporting rate. I can see that really clearly in the data. Bell Minor surprised me a little bit. That sort of went up from about 3.8 through 5.7, 6.3, 6.8, 5.9. Seems like a reasonably consistent boost. Like, is that doing better in the city now? That was an interesting one. Striated Pardalote, that was a bit of a surprise. I mean, that's gone from sort of 2.1, 3.7, 3.2, 4.2, 3.7 again. Like, that seems to be a bit of an upward slope. King Parrot, now this one seemed to match anecdotal evidence. People observing that King Parrot seems to be doing better in Melbourne these days. And that's borne out somewhat by the reporting rate here, 2.1, 2.5, 2.4, 3.0, 3.4. So that's a reasonably clear line upwards there on the King Parrot. You know, you're asking about which ones stand out. You know, people often ask about introduced birds, and, you know, I'll say, you know, these species aren't doing so well in the cities anymore, and there's inevitably going to be a person or two on a thread in Facebook who's going to say, it's the Indian miner. That's like burning them all out of their nesting hollows and stuff. And first of all, I've got to say, well, the official name of that species is the common miner. And the second thing is that the reporting rate for the common miner has declined, and it's one of the steeper declines across the 5 years that I looked at here. 50.1%, 46%, 45%, 39%, and then 40%. So that seems to indicate a bit of a decline in the reporting rate, and actually a substantial one. Starling was similar. Yeah, go ahead, Michael. Sorry.
Do you know if there's any control programs in place for common miners? Like, could that be producing that or not?
I would only be in the realm of speculation on that one, Michael. I think some people around the traps are, you know, around the traps highly enthusiastic about setting those traps, and you know, some people sort of form groups, cooperative groups, and I think some of the traps are actually sold in some of the large chain stores. Look, I would only be entering the realm of speculation there, and I just don't know, and I think it's a mixed bag anyway, the efficacy of control programs, or even like the actual supposed versus real impact of the common miner on native bird populations. It's not something that I think I can hope to answer. I mean, the weird thing was that even before I was pulling together this data, I kind of thought that I have fewer common miner in my neighborhood. And again, you know, we should only put so much stock in anecdotal observations like that, and we shouldn't get carried away with it. But it was just really interesting to see that that does appear to be somewhat borne out by the data that I pulled together here. And, you know, I should underscore at the end there, it still is showing up on 40% of Melbourne's checklist. So it's still a pretty common bird. Yeah. So yeah, it'd be interesting to see how that one goes in the long term.
Yeah, for sure. You were about to say something about starlings before I'd cut you off there.
Starlings, yeah, they're at the bottom of the list. Towards the bottom of the list as well. It's a similar rate of decline in reporting rate as the common miner. Starling, 34. I just ran up to the closest whole number. 34, 28, 28, 23, 24. So that seems to be going down a little bit. People often wonder about the house sparrow. The house sparrow seems to be way less commonly reported in Melbourne than it used to be. I mean, it still hangs on around, you know, inevitably shopping centres and food courts and the like. But house sparrow, 17, 14, 12 or 13, depending how you're at it, 10 and 11. Mm. So that's a notable decline.
Yeah, that's like, that's about half superb fairy wrens, which is, you would expect house sparrows to be more common than fairy wrens, you would expect.
Yeah, well, I suppose birders do tend to go places.
That's true. That's true.
Like,
Yeah.
so there is that. I mean, I do. I mean, I for one submit lists from home in my home neighborhood. But I mean, if I'm honest with you, I'm much more enthusiastic about getting out of home and going out somewhere very interesting and submitting a list, which might include birds that I haven't seen this year yet.
So have you looked into any data from other places outside of Melbourne? And if you have, did you find anything out similar or different?
Well, I haven't, as you and I are talking now, I haven't written up my Victoria story yet. I'll get onto that soon. But I have pulled together the data. So this is all of Victoria minus those Melbourne LGAs. So the way eBird divides us up, eBird uses a system where they're called counties. It doesn't really matter whether it's called counties or LGAs, but those counties in eBird match our local government areas in Victoria. And so what I've done is I've divided it up with a bit of help from Matt Smith, who is the very clever data genius behind the supremely nerdy and really quite fun fantasy birding game on the internet. You can ask me about that later on if you want. But what we've done is we've divided it all up. So I've got my urban or my Greater Melbourne LGAs, and I've got my everything else in Victoria except those. And the way it divides up, I think, is something like 50,000 approximately checklists were submitted across those 5 years for the Greater Melbourne. And then for all of Victoria, it's something like 107,000 checklists. So we've like got a pretty decent amount of data behind these findings. And when I look at it, Welcome Swallow was at the rock bottom of the list in Melbourne. And that's actually the same in Victoria. I don't really quite know what to make of that. And it's not one I would have really picked. So when I look at all of Victoria minus Melbourne, I've got 22 for the Welcome Swallow in 2015. So I'm going from 22%, 18%, 17, 15, 14. So that's a decline every year. Welcome Swallow showing up less frequently on birders' checklists in country Victoria. Really curious.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting to see what your whole report says once it comes out. And
Well, I can throw you a couple of other tidbits, Michael. It's not a secret. It's the data I stress is publicly available, so anyone can do this analysis. I'm not the gatekeeper of this. Anyone can download the histogram data and divide it up and do your own reporting. I encourage it. So I'll throw you a couple of other ones. What have I got here? Not surprising is that in rural Victoria or country Victoria outside of Melbourne, the rainbow lorikeet seems to be doing quite well. That won't come as a surprise to any bird, I don't think. 9%, 9%, 9.5%, 9.5%, and then almost 10%. So that's a solid and gradual increase. Scrolling further down here, I always look for those kind of usual suspects, but you don't always see them. I mean, some of the eruptive or nomadic species tend to spike the data out a bit when you look at country Victoria. Like we've had a couple of good years of wood swallows coming through, and that's you can I can see it. I can see clear spikes in the data here. Mast wood swallow and white-browed wood swallow. I won't bother to read the percentages, but I can tell you that those years where they were strong is definitely borne out on the data here. Crimson chat. This is a funny one because we had a massive influx of crimson chat into Victoria and South Australia, I believe. At the end of 2019. And so I'll round it again. So Crimson Chat 2015, 0, 16, 0, 17, 0, 18, 0, 19, 0.6% of all of the checklists submitted in country Victoria suddenly had the Crimson Chat showing up. So we had a massive influx in 2019, and it shows up just quite nicely on here as well. I'd be a little bit concerned looking at the superb fairy wren again, looking across Victoria. Is apparently declining, certainly in the reporting rate 25, 20, 20, 18, 18. So that's a decent decline. Willy Wagtail 19, 15, 15, 13, 12. Grey Fantail 17, sorry, Grey Fantail 16%, 14%, 13%, 12%, 11%. That worries me slightly, and there's just quite a lot like that. When you scroll up, a lot of sort of woodland birds, it seems, are on it. When I just look up some of these bottom ones, Silvereye, grey shrike thrush, brown thornbill, red wattlebird, New Holland honey eater. I wouldn't have guessed that one.
Do you have any ambitions to do more areas once you've completed the whole of Victoria?
You know, it could be almost infinite the amount of time you could spend on something like this, right? I wouldn't mind doing all of Australia. I mean, you know, I am selfish, of course, like all birders to a certain extent. I am interested in the birds that I might see or hear myself. And so, I focus on my home patch. You know, I live near the centre of Melbourne. I get out for birding in rural Victoria. So, of course, I'm interested in Victoria and I'll continue to ride up on that. I might do something on all of Australia as well, but that really means totaling up a vast number of checklists, which is not a problem, and then just looking at the reporting rates right across the board, right across all of Australia. I guess the problem with that is that you're talking about, in some cases, I think pretty infinitesimal reporting rates on species that you'd assume are common, but actually when you divide up the data, you know, the reporting rates on some of those species would be very small. So, you know, I'd be copying criticism on people saying, well, you know, you're almost within the margin of error there, Matthew. So, you know, what are you really trying to achieve with this? But, you know, I'd maintain that it's still coming off the back of a really large amount of data. And, you know, I haven't looked for the Australia totals recently, but, you know, Victoria was, as I said, across those 5 years was on 108,000. Plus those 49,000 for Melbourne. That's a lot of data. Mm. And if you expand that out across all of Australia, that's a huge amount of data. So look, I still think it might be interesting to look at, and I might do that at some point. No promises.
Mm. Yeah. Now, how does your love for data translate into fantasy birding? I will admit that I do know about the fantasy birding game, but I also know that most people don't. So do you want to just quickly, before we run out of time, do you want to just quickly give us an idea of what fantasy birding is?
Fantasy birding is one of the nerdiest little offshoots of one of the nerdiest hobbies you can imagine. So I'm talking pretty nerdy here now. So fantasy birding is a game I suppose people do this with fantasy sports, right? You choose players, and then when those players get goals or whatever, then your score goes higher or whatever, and you're competing with your mates. Well, fantasy birding is kind of like that. You each day you set a pin, and you must do that pin in advance, so you don't know what birds are going to show up. And then what the game does is it looks, it takes that pin and it draws a radius, and in that circle, you score whatever species were reported to eBird on that day within that circle. So it can get quite strategic because you've only got 365 days, and you have to have a bit of a sense of where and when there are going to be eBird lists submitted. Now, I'm a very mid-range player in this. I'm no champion of fantasy birding, but I mean, some of the players seem to have a supernatural ability to pick very effectively spots that are going to have a very good reporting rate for birds that that are highly sought after. So those are the people who are going to do very, very well in fantasy birding. But even for me, as a bit of a mid-range kind of, you know, just muddling around with it a little bit, it's really educational. I play two games. There are many different categories that the creator, Matt Smith, has worked out. I play the global game, in which I think I'm about halfway up, and I play the Australian game, of course, and I'm not doing too badly now. I think I'm number four or something, and probably a reasonably small field, to be honest. but still, it's quite fun, and you know, when you get the sort of all the basic birds in, it gets really quite strategic about how to pick the ones that you haven't seen yet, and you do tend to tell your mates when you hear that they're going out birding, oh, well, where are you going to be on which particular day? And I'll just make sure I follow you on fantasy birding because I still haven't got a white-fronted honey eater on my Australian game for 2020. So I need to get that sorted out. So I'll follow anyone who's doing any Mallee birding anytime soon.
the first time I heard about fantasy birding was somebody put a post up about the Eagle Hawk neck pelagic. and had a bit of a whinge, just humorously, had a bit of a whinge that it didn't go out on the day they were expecting it to go out, so they missed all the pelagic species.
That is crushing, I tell you. See, the smart fantasy birder will try and find out if the trip's actually going ahead in advance, so that they can move their pin somewhere else if the trip gets called off. I'm sure I'm a pest. I'm not sure if I'm so much of a pest that I'm going to get in touch with every pelagic trip around the world to find out if they're going out or not. At the moment, I suppose we're all called off anyway. But yeah. Look, it's such a fun game, and I've actually learned a lot, and so can anyone really. It's just a really fun way to get to know a little bit more about what birds are found where, and sometimes you put a pin down on a location, especially in the global game, and you'll get birds roll again that, you know, you've just never heard of. And there's still 10,500 species on the planet, hopefully, and there's heaps in there that I've not heard of, and heaps in there that you have not heard of, I bet. So and discovering them and having a little avenue to learn a bit more about them with a game like this is a heap of fun, and it also, you know, taps into that competitive aspect that we have as well, that mysterious competitive aspect that birders have. So you can let off a bit of steam there just in a fun fantasy gaming environment as well. I love it.
You've obviously been around Australia a fair bit birding. One question that I ask everyone who comes on the show is if they've got a bucket list location that every Australian birder needs to visit at some point in their birding life. Do you have a location that would fit that criteria?
Oh, that's tough, isn't it? Well, I think, yes, something does spring to mind, because I've always had such great experiences when I've gone there. I don't know that you would get the most species there. And of course, there's always going to be somewhere else that, you know, picks up more of this or that common species. But I've had such terrific experiences in Southern Wiperfeld National Park in the Mallee region of Victoria. So that's in the northwest part of Victoria, I suppose about halfway between Melbourne and Adelaide. And there's just something magic about that southern part of Wiperfeld National Park. The dunes, the ancient dunes that are sort of now grown over with low woodland, the Mallee woodland. And it's scenically beautiful. The birds are fabulous. I bumped into Mallee emu wren there once, which caused a bit of a flurry amongst people who are interested in such things. And there's just something remote and recharging about it, which I can't recommend highly enough. So next time you're traveling in South Australia or Victoria and you want to get some of those Mallee birds in, I can't recommend Southern Wiperfeld highly enough. And you know what? Northern Wiperfeld's not too bad either, now that I think about it.
Well, Matthew, thank you for coming on the show. Good luck with your 30-hour Twitchathon. Hopefully we're all allowed to go out and participate, and we look forward to seeing what data you come out with in the future.
My pleasure, Michael. Thanks very much for having me on. I really give you a big round of applause for what you're doing with the podcast. I hope this goes really well. People listening, make sure you help out Michael and share it around a little bit, and make sure other birders are listening in as well, and let's hope that we get a sustain this voice in the birding scene. I think it's a great thing you're doing, Michael.
Thank you very much. So thanks everyone for listening. Hope you found that as informative as I did. I will make a shameless plug for the birding tourism sector, just because I can. All of us guides are sitting at home, twiddling our thumbs, nothing to do, raring to go. So if you are looking for a way to help support the local economy, booking a birding tour for a day, or maybe a week or two, would be a great place to start. I would recommend booking with Bellbird Tours because A, I work for them, and B, they're the best. That would be a good choice. I will put the website in the podcast information. But whatever you do, I hope you have a brilliant weekend and a great week next week. And until next time, happy birding.